This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The Knight and the Moth, The Stonewater Kingdom, Book 1. Written by Rachel Gillick. Read by Samantha Heidson. To the child in each of us, yearning to be special. Take my hand, you strange little creature, and together we shall walk beyond the wall. Ashling Cathedral. You know this story, Bartholomew, though you do not remember it. I'll tell it to you as best I can, and promise to be honest in my tale-bearing. If I'm not, that's hardly my fault. To tell a story is, in some part, to tell a lie, isn't it? Once, you came upon Traum's highest tor, where the wind whispered a minor tune. There, the Gowan flowers were white and the stones were grey, and both stole the warmth from your bare feet. A cathedral was built there, and you tiptoed, small as an insect, through the narthex, into the nave, down the aisle. Blood stained your lips, and you fell into the spring that came from that ancient stone upon the chancel. When you looked up at the rose window, the light kissed stained glass. Your craft was obedience. You said the names of gods and how to read their signs. You learned how to dream and how to drown. I'm sorry. I don't care to go back to this part of the story either, Bartholomew, but I so often wonder, could the rest exist without it? Chapter 1. Six Maidens Upon a Wall. The peculiar gargoyle, who spoke mostly in broken parables, shuffled to the dim corner of the ambulatory. There, strung between iron candlesticks, a spider's web held a fly captive. Incessant buzzing! The gargoyle wagged a limestone finger at the fly, his craggy voice echoing through the cathedral.
Serves you right. If I've told you once, I've told you 1,000 times. Watch where you are going. Now.
He leaned close and peered at the web.
Hold still. I'm going to extract you from this snare.
He did not extract the fly. He went on, lecturing the poor insect on the dangers of flight. Had the fly been capable of reason, it might have concluded it was better to die in the clutches of a spider than be the subject of this particular gargoyle's attentions. But the fly could not speak, and thus uttered no complaint. It just kept on buzzing, and the gargoyle kept on talking. And that was how I was able to slip from the pew I was dusting to watch the king ride up the hill. Into the nave I ran, bare feet slapping against stone. Then I was out of the cathedral, accosted by the sunset, its light filtering through the gossamer shroud I wore around my eyes. The gravel courtyard was empty, visiting hours at an end. The only figures present were 5 limestone statues, 5 faceless, hooded figures. They stood nigh 10 spans high, their ancient arms held open in beckoning. All 5 were identical, but for their left hands, each clasping a distinct stone object. One statue held a coin, another an inkwell. One bore an oar, another a chime, and the final a loom stone. I wove between the statues on tiptoe, touched by the pervasive fear that I would anger them if I wandered too loudly. But they were mere stone, tendering neither ire nor love. Still, they watched me through the darkness of their hoods, predatory in their stillness. I felt them, just as I felt Ashling Cathedral's gaze, with its eyes of stained glass, silent and ancient and disapproving, upon my back. I hurried on. The courtyard gave way to grass, and stone was replaced by an orchard of gnarled fruit trees. It was late summer, and blood-red apples hung in clusters. I raised a hand above my head and ripped one from its branch without breaking my stride. When I broke through the orchard, a long stone wall stood ahead of me. Upon it, five maidens waited. They wore the same pale fabric as I did, their eyes shrouded with identical gossamer. Perched high upon old stones, bathed in sunset light, their dresses caught the wind. They looked like five flags of surrender there upon the wall. As if sensing their last counterpart, the women turned as I approached. The tallest, who waved at me from the cathedral doors and hissed, "It's the bloody king!" cupped her hands around her mouth and hollered, "Hurry!" I put the apple between my teeth and pressed calloused fingers onto old stones. 12 spans high and fraught with lichen, the wall was difficult to scale. But nearly 10 years can make a master out of anyone. The stones were a familiar adversary. I hauled myself up. The women made room for me, and I swung a leg over and straddled the wall. "You're sure it's him?" Two, I didn't know her name, only her number, tall and solemn, pointed a finger over the vista. I saw purple banners beyond that bluff. Swear it on my mother. "Might mean a bit more if you had a mother," Three muttered. "Give it a moment," Two said, spine like a rod. "You'll see that I'm right." Next to me, Five pushed her orange hair out of her face. The wind shoved it right back. "Are you going to share?" she said, nodding at my apple. I offered the fruit up. "It's not very sweet." "Blech!" She made a face and threw the apple over the wall. It fell with a thud onto the side of the road, a red pinprick among greenery. "How can you eat that?" "I suppose we'll never know." On my other side, Four twisted a fistful of wild black curls. She rested an arm on my shoulder, and our gazes met. Or I assumed they did. It was impossible to tell, with the shroud that covered their faces from their brows to the bridge of their noses, where any of the women were truly looking. I did not know their names, and I did not know the colour of their eyes. I did not know the colour of my eyes. "I'll be damned." A smile crept over Four's lips. "Here he comes." We turned. There, from the east, peeking out from knolls of green, purple banners. I squinted. Seeing through my shroud was akin to peering through steam off a kettle. But the tor upon which the cathedral sat was so high, and Traum's hills so sprawling, and the air so clear, that it was no trouble working out the details of King Castor's procession the moment the hills spat it into view. There were nearly 2 dozen of them, bannermen and squires, and knights. What a display they made! Daylight danced over their armour, and the noise of them caught the wind, sounding over the tor in echoes, distorting their words into a false translation. Even at a distance, I could see which one was King Benedict Castor. His armour was not the same silvery iron as his knights, but gilt, as if he were the sun, and they a cluster of lesser stars. It was my first time seeing the boy king. The procession dipped behind a roll in the tor. In 10 minutes, it would pass directly beneath the wall where we, like expectant sparrows, perched. One tapped her chin. "That's a lot of knights just for a divination." Four grinned. "Lucky for us." "I hear this king is a child," Three said, in her usual flat way, like she was reading the words instead of speaking them. "That he shakes at his own shadow. Perhaps he fancied protection in spooky old Ashling." "Swords and armour mean nothing here," I whispered to the wind. The others nodded. On that note, one reached into the shapeless billows of her dress and extracted 6 stalks of straw. Gather, shrews. We let out a collective groan, then shifted on the wall. When we'd finished moving, 2 stood directly in front of 1 and her fistful of straw. The game was simple. Don't get the short straw. 2 examined the straws, plucking a long straw from the centre of the bundle. 1 pulled from the edge, another long straw. They kept pulling until only a pair of straws remained. After a pause, 1 took her turn, yanked her chosen straw free, and grinned. The short straw goes to you, 2. 2's chin was high as she looked down the line of us. Get over here, 3. The rounds of the game continued. 2 defeated 3 and smugly went to stand next to 1, while the rest of us bit our nails and waited for our turns. 3 defeated 4, and so did 5. By the time 4 faced me, her final opponent, she was as rigid as a tin soldier. Shuffling to a dance only we knew, we rotated along the wall, the sounds from the king's procession growing louder. 4 held the straws in a stranglehold and nodded at me. You first. I studied the frayed yellow edges and chose a long straw. So did 4. Horses whickered and knights laughed in the near distance. I chose again, another long straw. Another for 4, 2. The final straws. 3 let out a low whistle. Worried you'll be too sick to flirt, 4. Shut up. 4 jerked her chin at me. Go on. I knew what she was thinking. It's what all of us were thinking. Why we'd played the same game 100 times before. I don't want to be the one to dream. Wind stirred my cropped silver blonde hair, but my eyes did not leave the straws. The distinct pattern in their tattered yellow tips. This one. The women all leaned forward, and the straws were revealed. 2 let out a laugh. You're a lucky bitch, 4. I'd chosen the short straw. 4's laugh was coated in relief. Just as well, 6. You're the favourite. You never thrash in the water. I took the straw into my toughened palm, the little thing ugly and brittle, then plopped to a seat on the wall, just as the procession's first riders came into view. The first, riding a pale warhorse with nary a grass stain upon its flank, was the king. Benedict Castor did not ride with an iron spine, the way I'd seen his predecessor, King Augur, grey of eye, grey of hair, cold and disinterested, did. Indeed, King Castor seemed slightly bent in his saddle, creaking in his armour as if unaccustomed to its grip, like a squire playing dress-up. His cheeks were round and his jaw naked. I wondered if he even needed to shave. Imagine, 5 said, 17, and chosen by the knighthood to protect the faith. 17, and already a king. Everything in the world to prove, 1 murmured, looking down at him. King Castor passed beneath us and did not look up, unaware that he was being watched. But when 4 sighed, the king's bannerman lifted his gaze. When he saw us upon the wall, his eyes went wide. Diviners, he mouthed, though no sound came out. Then, bolder, he called to the knights behind him. 6 maidens upon the wall! Diviners! There was a loud shuffle, whickering horses. The knights rode into view. There were women as well as men within their ranks, all variant in appearance. Some had the distinguished pale hair of the Cliffs of Belledine, or the sharp, angled features of those who lived near the fervent peaks. One knight, axe slung over her shoulder, had charcoal painted around her eyes, distinctive to the chiming wood. Diviner, a knight called, raising the visor of his helmet. He was looking up at 4. Beautiful mystic. I have slain sprites, defended the omens and the faith. Pray, for my glad devotion, lend a kiss. More knights craned their necks, took off their helmets to survey us better. Some said the knight's creed in greeting. Others threw gown flowers and pleaded, oh, how they pleaded, for our attention, our words, our kisses, though the wall was too high, and we were more satisfied to watch them beg than to offer up our lips. I leaned forward and tried to see their eyes. The abbess and the five women with me upon the wall all wore shrouds. Besides visitors to the cathedral, the only eyes I regularly glimpsed belonged to the gargoyles, and they, fashioned of stone, were like looking upon the cathedral itself. Astounding to behold, and entirely lifeless. The bells began to ring. The king's procession thinned, the last of the knights riding beneath us. The diviners moved along the wall with practiced balance to follow, but I remained seated. I opened my hand and let the broken pieces of the short straw dance away, caught by a fickle northern wind. The cathedral bells kept ringing, insistent in their peals. I pushed to my feet to heed them, preparing myself for what came next. A horse whickered from below. Stalled on the road, a final knight remained. His horse had come to a full stop and was chewing noisily on something it had found in the greenery beside the road. My apple. The knight tried to spur the animal on, but the horse, grunting its contentedness, was having a love affair with the apple. It did not budge. A muffled string of profanity sounded beneath an armoured helmet. The knight shifted in his saddle at the din of the cathedral bells, tilting his head upward, affording me a view of the dark slit in his visor from which he surveyed the world. There was no seeing his eyes, no way for him to glimpse mine through my shroud. Still, I felt it, somewhere between my stomach and throat, the instant he spotted me on the wall. His shoulders went rigid. Slowly, he reached for his helmet, removed it. There was a mess of black hair. He shoved it from his face, and I drew in a breath. Sharp features, dark brows, a prominent nose. His skin was olive, golden from the sun, yet there was no warmth in his face. Light caught along the three gold bands pierced into his right ear. Severe, rimmed in charcoal, his eyes were so brown they might easily be mistaken for black. There was no warmth in them, either. He watched me, his gaze wide, then immediately narrow. Slowly, his mouth twisted into a sneer, its meaning unmistakable. What the hell are you looking at? The other knights had all smiled at me, unchallenging and awestruck and reverent. This one, it seemed, had no such compulsion. Knight, I called. You lot make quite the spectacle. Is the king so fretful that he requires the company of his entire knighthood for a divination? The knight's gaze remained tight. He said nothing. I asked if your king...
Between our two lots, mine is hardly the spectacle.
I blinked. Excuse me? He issued no clarification, his armor creaking as he continued to measure me with unfriendly eyes. I straightened, looming over him like one of the cathedral's spires. A respectable knight would just as soon bite off his own tongue than speak to a daughter of Ashling like that. He pressed his lips together, like I'd told him a joke at my own expense. A craggy voice called behind me.
Bartholomew!
I whirled. In the orchard, touched by the looming shadow of the cathedral, was the same peculiar gargoyle I'd left in the ambulatory. He called to me again.
Get down at once, Bartholomew. We are needed inside.
I glanced back at the road. The knight had managed to spur his horse and was riding fast to catch up to the others. I frowned at his receding figure.
I say, Bartholomew, can you hear me?
The gargoyle brandished a chastising finger.
Climb down this instant.
I heard you. I heard you. I grasped the edge of the wall and lowered myself until my bare feet touched grass. There were 23 gargoyles at Ashling Cathedral, and no two alike. Composed of limestone, they bore an unsettling combination of human and animal qualities, most fitted with wings and the gift of flight. This one had a protruding brow, fangs, claws, and wings like a bat carved behind his back, though I'd never seen him fly because, apparently, the skies are feckless and it would be an insult beyond recovery to be mistaken for a bird. But as much as they were distinct, the gargoyles were also all alike. They all bore a strange allegiance to Ashling Cathedral, dedicated to the Tor and always minding the abbess, as if of the cathedral. They grunted, but rarely spoke. Save this one. I approached, my hands out in supplication. When it came to this particular gargoyle, who called everyone and everything Bartholomew for no discernible reason, it was better to be contrite. When he took to sulking, it lasted for days. Apologies, I said. When I stood next to him, his brow was at my shoulder. I was chastising an idiot.
A happy pastime, as you've proven to me on many occasions. But the king is upon us, with nary a warning. The utter gall of men.
He rolled his stone eyes.
Have you chosen among yourselves who will dream in the spring?
I will.
Very good.
He held out his claw-tipped hand.
Hurry.
He led me back through the gnarled apple orchard. We hastened through the courtyard, past the statues, returning, as if reeled back by a lure, to the cathedral. Day was succumbing to night when we reached the tall oaken doors. The abbess was there, waiting. I could not see her face, nor any of her skin. Her shroud, a pale curtain that stretched to her chin, covered her face entirely, and her hands were protected in white silken gloves. It was only the tightness of her fists at her side, the note of ice in her voice, that gave her dissatisfaction away.
It seems the king has come for an unexpected divination, Benedict Castor III.
She said his name quickly, like something bitter she wished to spit out. Apparently, the abbess did not think much of the new boy king. Wind rippled over her shroud.
You will be dreaming, Six?
Yes. A low, of approval sounded in her throat, and I felt my chest swell. The abbess touched my cheek, stepped aside, so that the gargoyle and I could pass into the narthex, then closed the cathedral doors behind us. Ashling Cathedral was dark, cold. Its stagnant air smelled of limestone and mahogany, but not enough to mask the sickly sweet odour of rotting flowers that came from within.
I washed the divining robes this morning.
The gargoyle led me down the nave. On the final pew, six silk robes waited.
It was an abundant chore. I am within myself with fatigue.
Beside, I murmured, peeling off my clothes. Beside myself with fatigue is the proper expression. The gargoyle's stone brow knit.
If I were beside myself, there would be two of me, and the washing would have taken half the time.
He turned his back before I could reply, and let me work the buttons of my clothes in privacy. First off was the billowing gossamer overgown. Next came the thin, flaxen chemise. I wore no jewellery, no knit leggings, no shoes. I eased off my braids and let them drop down my legs. When I was done, the only fabric left on my body was my shroud. Naked, I shivered. The divining robes were still warm from the clothesline. I took the one with V1 embroidered into its cuff, white and unblemished and silken, so much finer than the clothes I'd just stripped away. The robe felt decadent, but not comforting. I'm ready. I'm ready, my echo taunted, ricocheting against the cathedral's stone walls. The gargoyle turned. He looked upon me with stone eyes and offered his hand once more, leading me onto the transept. There, situated in the center of the cathedral, like a heart, was the spring. A great limestone had fissured long ago, and Ashling was built around it. From the stone's wide fissure, an ancient spring leached like a long, narrow bath. Its water was oily and dark, and smelled of rotting flowers. The cathedral bells rang again. There was tightness in my chest, tightness in my throat. I approached the spring slowly, lifted the hem of my robe. The gargoyle handed me in. The viscous water reached just above my navel. It, like everything in the cathedral, was cold. I shivered, the spring taking me into its frigid womb, lapping up the silk of my robe, rendering it translucent. I looked up. Above me, high in the cathedral's cloister, 5 stained glass windows loomed, each depicting a stone object, the same objects held in the hands of the courtyard statues. A coin, an inkwell, an oar, a chime, and a loom stone. The 6th and final window was centered on the east wall, an enormous rose window, fixed with thousands of pieces of stained glass. Its design was different than the others, depicting no stone object, but rather a flower with 5 peculiar petals that, when I studied them, looked all the world like the delicate wings of a moth. The final rays of daylight set the windows aglow, but the light remained high, out of reach. The spring I stood in was the holiest place in Traum, and yet I was in darkness. Silent. They came from the shadows of the transepts. 6 more gargoyles. They marched until they'd positioned themselves around the spring like hour markers on a sundial. The cathedral doors pushed open. The king's knights came into the narthex. They were hushed now, as if Ashling Cathedral had sucked the words from their mouths. Helmets removed, their heads lifted as they took in the artistry of the cathedral, its fine marble floors, its carved reliefs and vaulted ceilings and stained glass window. The bells stopped ringing. Behind his knights came King Castor, walking side by side with the abbess. With his glimmering armor and her pale robes, her shroud like a veil, they might have been bride and bridegroom, taking the long walk down the nave to say their vows upon the chancel. The difference was, a bride does not hold a knife. The knights found their seats upon the pews. When the abbess and the king reached the stone in the heart of the cathedral, they stood opposite each other, directly in front of me. The abbess spoke as she always did during a divination, without feeling. This is your first time being divined for, Benedict Castor. Have you brought your offering? The king stood before me, his blue eyes wide and glassy. 20 gold pieces. And what is it you wish to learn from this diviner's dream? Nothing. A touch of red bloomed across the king's face, his voice coming out frayed. That is, I want to know if they favour me, I suppose, now that I am the new king of Traum. He trembled, and I stood perfectly still. The poor boy was afraid, and he looked even younger for it, despite his distinguished armour. I wondered if, in that moment, I was seeing Benedict Castor more clearly than anyone ever had. It was why I loved being a diviner. I felt so much wiser, stronger, standing in Ashling Spring. It was grotesque, but it roused me, even if I hated what came next. The abbess stayed silent a long while. Then, slowly, she handed the King of Traum the knife.
Then, begin.
Chapter 2. Omens. The blade made no noise when King Castor cut himself. He did it over the heart line of his palm, then curled his fingers, holding the responding swell of blood in his hand like a chalice holds wine. It was a sacred act, giving a bit of oneself up for the art of divination. The abbess took King Castor by the wrist and brought his bloody hand to my mouth. The king went grey and turned his gaze to the wall, like he could not bear the sight of his blood, or me. Drink, the abbess commanded. I opened my mouth, and the king's blood poured over my tongue, viscous and warm. It tasted vile. Blood always did. I swallowed, straining against the urge to be sick. The abbess began her oration. Traum is an old name for an even older land. Its history is as outlandish, as lurid, as a dream. But in many ways, its true history began upon this very She paused, turning to the king. Though perhaps a Castor like yourself would not like to hear the story I tell before a divination. Shall we simply proceed with the dream? King Castor shuffled his feet. I would like to do things the proper way. Please, go on. The abbess touched my cheek, a familiar act of silent affection, then continued. We know Traum and its hamlets like our own five fingers. Coulson Fair, the hamlet of merchants. The scholarly city heart, the siege, the hamlet of scribes. The fervent peaks near the mouth of our river, the hamlet of fishers. The cosseted birch forest, the chiming wood, where the foresters dwell. The florid cliffs of Belladine, occupied by weavers. The abbess sighed. The old stories vary, of course, but in one way they are all alike. Traum was full of monstrous creatures, sprites who roamed the hamlets. Folk tried to fight them, but the hamlets were not unified, floundering without gods, without divine principles, without a ruler. And when none of those things exist, there are inevitable tragedies, I recited to myself. There are inevitable tragedies. The abbess's voice echoed. Food and coin and children were stolen from the hamlets by sprites. Murder was committed. Crops died, boats crashed, wool was infested by beetles. Soon, Traum's people were like sprites themselves, wild creatures, strange and ravenous, and entirely without virtue.
Sounds like a good time to me,
one of the knights muttered. King Castor managed a shaky grin. I glowered at him from behind my shroud. The abbess continued. The deaths grew, and so did discord between the hamlets. Until one night, one dark, lonely night, when the air was so cold, it painted the sky an incomparable purple hue. Six gods visited Traum. A scoff echoed through the cathedral. Armor rattled, and low voices sounded. Then one of the knights was pushing away from a pew, his steps loud on the stone floor. He shoved the cathedral door open, evening light flittering through dark hair, and over three gold bands in his right ear. The knight from the road. He cast one baleful look over his shoulder, then kicked the ancient wood door shut behind him. The abbess waited for the echoes of his departure to settle, then continued, unperturbed. One dark, lonely night, a foundling child left its hamlet and climbed a looming tor in search of food. The tor did not offer much life, save whispering grass and gown flowers and pale moths. But then, a spring, a strange spring, at the top of the tor, leeching from a great stone. The child came to the lip of the water, drank deeply. She drew in an affected breath, and was swept into a dream. I'd heard the story so many times I could see it in my mind. A child, like I'd been when I'd come to Aisling Cathedral, lying in dark water before transfixed onlookers. It made me proud that a foundling, like me, should be the most important figure in Traum's most sanctified story. Even if that child didn't have a name. The abbess carried on. When the child woke, sick and weak, it told passers-by a vivid tale of six unearthly figures who had visited its wakeless mind, shadowy figures who bore stone objects, each object possessing unique power. The child's tale grew legs, and folk of the hamlets came to the tor to see the spring. Again and again, the child drank the water and dreamed. In time, the child learned that the movements of the stone objects were presages, and so the gods who wielded them were named. Omens, I whispered. Omens, the abbess repeated. She lifted a finger, pointing to the windows on high, and every soul in the cathedral raised their eyes to the stained glass. The omen who bore a stone coin, the child named the Artful Brigand. The omen fitted with the inkwell was christened the Harried Scribe. The omen who wielded a stone oar was called the Ardent Oarsman. The faithful forester carries the chime. She pointed at the last arched window. And the heartsaw weaver employs her sacred loomstone. The abbess directed her finger to the final window, the great rose window. But the sixth omen bore no stone object. It revealed nothing of itself at all, appearing only as a pale moth on tender wing. Some say it shows itself the moment you are born. Others believe it comes just before you die. Which is true, she opened her palms like two pans of a scale. We cannot know. We may read their signs, but it is not our place to question the gods. The moth is mercurial, distant, never to be known, even by diviners. She put a gloved hand to her chest. Of course, there are those of us who have long believed the omens are vaster than the dreamscape they occupy, that the moth and the others exist, hidden in the hamlets, killing horrible sprites and swaying the fate of Traum with their magical stone objects, ever present, always watching. Saliva pooled in my mouth, heavy and tasting of iron. It was almost time. And so, the abbess said, we find ourselves in the center of Traum's greatest story. A great cathedral was built upon the spring's tor, and more foundling children were brought there to dream, and they became daughters of Aisling, revered diviners. A king was crowned, and Traum's five hamlets were unified by belief, thusly named the Stonewater Kingdom. The king's knights were tasked with defending the faith as well as they defended the hamlets against sprites. She paused, looming over young Benedict Castor, whose eyes were on his feet. And the king swore to be more supplicant than sovereign, that he would never take up the mantle of his faith for personal gain, never seek the omens or their stone objects for his own power or vanity. For in the end, the abbess said, we are all supplicants. Whether craftsman or a king, knight or foundling or diviner, faith is the same. It, like Aisling Cathedral, holds up the hamlets. And while we all bear our own creeds, we must never forget, It is the omens who rule, Tom. Omens who scrawl the signs. We are but witnesses to their wonders, pupils of their portents. She raised her hands in beckoning. Ever but visitors to their greatness. Ever but visitors, I called.
Ever but visitors, the king murmured.
Ever but visitors,
the knighthood echoed. The gargoyles closed in around the spring. Breath shuddered out of me. What name, with blood, would you give the omens? I said to the king. He startled, as if he'd forgotten me. Benedict Castor III. The abbess put her hands on my shoulders. Lie down, she instructed me. The smell of rotting flowers, the taste of blood, the slip of oily water were everywhere. I lay on my back in the spring, looking up into Ashling's reaching cloister and the windows therein, it in light, I in darkness. The abbess leaned over me. Dream, came her final, resolute command. She pressed down on my clavicle, hard enough to bruise. I sank into cold, terrible water. I shut my eyes, opened my mouth, sucked water into my lungs, and choked. My body spasmed once, twice, a ripple in the spring. Then I did what I'd always done since my very first day at Ashling Cathedral. I drowned. There was pain. Pain. Then nothingness. A bright, pallid nothingness. I lay on a clean stone floor, looking up at the same windows as before. Only now it seemed much higher, the vaulted cathedral roof cloudy, as if far above me in the sky. Gargoyles, diviners, the abbess and the king and his knights were gone. Not even the mahogany pews remained. I was alone in a pale, liminal version of Ashling that had never existed in my waking hours. I got to my feet. My robe had disappeared. The only stitch of fabric I wore now was my shroud. I looked down at my nakedness, hair and flesh, fat, muscle, and bone. A strange laugh bubbled in my throat. I always felt a mile wide after swallowing blood and water and drowning in the spring, as if I were infinite, holding all that discomfort so well within my body. It made me sick with self-loathing and flushed with pride. A shadow shifted in the corner of my eye. I turned, but the shadow flickered, then vanished. I was small in the vast space. Omens, I called. I am your harbinger, your dreamer, ever but a visitor. I've come to divine. Silence. Then, the cathedral began to ripple. Light blurred away the details, pillars and windows and buttresses all caught in a strange, undulating glow. I walked through the pale nothingness, the world sluggish, but my heart upon a hummingbird beat. The cathedral rippled in earnest. Dark spots, like stains upon fabric, perforated the wide, white space. I've tasted the blood of Benedict Castor III. Once more, I said. I've come to divine. The cathedral rippled, rippled, then winked out entirely. The floor beneath my feet gave way, and I fell through seams of light into darkness. My stomach lurched, hands and feet hollowed out as my body gave way to the sense of falling. A flash of silver in the darkness. Then, my knees hit first, then my hands, the substance beneath them cold and hard and unsteady. I swallowed a groan and teetered. Tipped, toppled, then rolled over myself like a pin over dough. There was a chorus of clinking, and when I stopped rolling, twisted and naked and already bruising, I braced myself and sat up. Coins. I'd fallen upon a bed of coins. Hundreds, thousands of coins stacked in a dark room. I scanned my surroundings, looked up. There were purple banners in the room, long windows, and an illuminating blue sky. Still, I could see the ghost of Aisling's buttresses, her vaulted ceilings, her cold stone innards. They'd have dragged me out of the spring by now. Once rendered unconscious by the drowning, a diviner was always pulled from the water and laid down to dream upon the chancel, set on her back with open arms, like an offering. I could still hear what was happening outside my dream, but the sound was muddled. Well, the abbess's faraway voice called. I opened my mouth to answer, then saw it. A coin, different from the rest, suspended in air. One side was smooth stone, the other dark and rutted and rough. The artful brigand's coin, I called. I can see it. The rough side is up. I let out a breath. A presage of bad fortune. If the abbess responded, I didn't hear it. The floor beneath my feet vanished, coins raining into darkness, and me with them. I fell with an unceremonious oomph onto wool carpet. The coins were gone. I was in a new space, a dark corridor with high walls covered in paintings that, no matter how hard I squinted, I could not make out. They looked like bodies, naked like mine, contorted into all manner of shapes. High above, nigh transparent, Aisling's ceiling loomed. My steps made no sound upon the carpet, but my heart was frantic. To drown in Aisling's cathedral's magical spring, to dream of the omens, was always like this. Painful. Eerie. No matter how many times I dreamed, I could not escape the keen sense of entrapment that settled over me, as if someone I could not see, a hooded figure, perhaps, was watching me, darkening the edges of my periphery. My lower back, my underarms, the soles of my bare feet dampened with sweat. Then it wasn't just sweat. Something wet leached onto my feet, cold as it burrowed between my toes. I saw it then, an inkwell at the edge of the corridor, black ink spilling from it onto the carpet like a bleeding wound. "The Harrod Scribe's inkwell," I said, making my voice as loud as I could. "It's overturned, leaching black ink. A terrible sign." Whispers sounded above me. Then the ink, the carpet, the corridor were all falling away, and so was I. I plummeted through the darkness, through nothingness, into one grey light. A rush of air slapped me over the face. There were no coins, no carpet to catch me this time, just jagged, unforgiving shale and mountainous stone. I put out my hands to catch myself, and slammed onto a boulder, shattering my collarbone. "Where are you now, Six?" I gnashed and writhed and swallowed the overpowering urge to be sick, hot agony scraping over me. "Six." The abbess's voice was an echo, but no less commanding. I'd watched Four dream once. I'd been young and curious to know what I must look like while divining. But seeing Four drown had unnerved me so acutely I'd nearly left. Then the abbess, who was so much stronger than I'd estimated, pulled Four out of the spring like she weighed no more than a broom, and laid her down, supine, upon the chancel. I'd always imagined there was flailing, maybe even writhing, involved in the craft of divination. To dream of the omens was to fall into nightmares, and the pain I felt while unconscious was as real to me as the pain in my waking life. But Four had just lain there, looking peaceful. Only her voice, slipping from her parted lips, lent animation to her disquiet. She'd groaned, screamed, After, she told me that she'd landed on her back atop the artful brigand's pile of coins and knocked the wind from herself. But all I'd heard was a gasp, and all I'd seen was a motionless girl in a wet silk robe, arms open in beckoning, lying upon the chancel. And for some perverse reason, I liked that. Knowing I could hold so much pain without anyone being the wiser made me feel strong, even if my broken collarbone fucking hurt. With my good arm, I pushed myself to my knees. My breasts and stomach were covered with scrapes from the rocks. When I looked out, it was upon a basin of water, surrounded by 7 mountain peaks, each of them so sheer, so jagged, they looked like the storybook claws of an ancient craggy giant. But it wasn't them I was looking to. It was the water. The crystalline blue water within the basin, and the large stone ore suspended over it. "I'm in the mountains," I said through clenched teeth. "The ardent oarsman's oar does not touch the water. There is no current. Another bad sign for the king." There was a drop in my stomach. Here we go again. And then I was no longer standing upon rocks or looking out on water, but alone in a woodland. My broken collarbone, the cuts in my skin, were gone. I stood in a wood of pale birch trees, nary a soul in sight. But I was not alone. Warm light flitted through a canopy of yellow leaves. The birch trees bore no branches and swayed on a breeze like sallow arms, grasping for the thin visage of Aisling's ceiling. I listened. There, a chime hung in the tree before me, a stone chime that called several high, unsteady notes. "The faithful forester's chime rings discordantly," I called, "an ill portent." I couldn't hear the abbess's voice. I imagined her gloating behind her shroud at King Castor. 4 stone objects, 4 bad signs. Only one left. The chime stopped short. The wood went silent, and the birch trees, the trees stood tightly bound, nearer than before, like a pack of wolves tightening ranks around a lost deer. This close, I could see their pale bark was not translucent or papery as a birch's might be. No, this bark was mottled, heavy, like old flesh, and the knots in the trunks, gashes of darkness in all that pale, sloughing bark, were eyes. Hundreds of black, lidless eyes watching me. The wood disappeared. When the world righted, I lay upon earth that was hard and cold and slimy. The air was dank and close, and I could hardly see my own nakedness. Everything was painted by blackness. "I'm in the dark," I called. "I'm in the dark," my echo recited from far away. I knew what came next. I had dreamed of all the places I had visited hundreds of times over. The room full of coins, the carpeted corridor, the mountains, the birch forest, and now this, the dank darkness. And I knew what stone objects awaited me and how to interpret them. I was good at reading the signs, which was why it shamed me, after all this time, that I should be so loath to do it. That I should still be afraid to dream. I got to my feet and shuffled forward, hands out in front of me. For a time there was nothing, just blackness and the sound of my pulse in my ears. Then, silver light. High above, moonlight filtered in through narrow cracks, as if I were looking out at the night sky from within a huge, dark egg. It wasn't much light, just enough to keep me from slamming my shins into the stone bench stationed against the wall. Upon it sat a tapestry, faded and frayed. Tied to the bottom of its threads, weighing them down, was a loomstone. The Heartsaw Weaver's loomstone, I called, stomaching the urge to whisper. It hangs from frayed thread, the fifth bad sign. I shook my head. That's an answer to King Castor's question. The omens do not favor him. Voices echoed from far away. The dream had served its purpose. The abbess would wake me now. A noise sounded. Footsteps in the dark. Not a thump like a cobbled shoe or boot or even a bare foot might make, but harsh, like stone upon stone. Clack, clack, they went. Clack, clack, right behind me. I whirled. There was no one there. My skin prickled, the cloying feeling that I was being watched heightening all my senses. Clack, clack, near and far. The silver moonlight blotted out, plunging me into true darkness. I bit down on a cry and did what I always did at this part of the dream. Ran. I fled through the dark innards of the dream until I was falling, plummeting into bottomless blackness, into nothingness. I fell, fell. Six, came the abbess's voice. I woke with a wrenching gasp. Chapter 3. The Foulest Night in All of Traum. My name is Sybil Delling, by the way. Was Sybil Delling. I don't remember who gave me that name, but I do remember the day that I lost it. I was a foundling girl, held in strong arms, coughing on water that tasted of rotting flowers. I can't recall how I found myself in Ashling's spring, or anything of my life before it, but I do remember sobbing, and that my cries echoed near and far, as if 100 girls were wailing. The woman who held me was shrouded, bearing the voice I'd come to know as the abbess's. She loomed over me, telling me that the sick little girl I was before, little Sybil Delling, was gone. She asked if I wished to exact a divine hand over Traum, if I would give her 10 years of my time in exchange for her love and care. What answer was there to give but yes? And then she drowned me. After, I was sick. The abbess held me in her arms and told me that the spring was holy and magical, and that by drowning in it, I had become holy and magical too, forever changed. That my memory had washed from me the moment the water had touched my lips, as if I'd been reborn. She called me strange, special, new. More importantly, she called me hers, and said it with such pride that I spent my days chasing her approval that I might hear it again. She soothed my stringy silver hair from my eyes, and tied a strip of gossamer over them, telling me I would not be safe outside the cathedral, because people in Traum wanted holy things for themselves. She bade me to guard my face, my name, until my 10 years at Ashling Cathedral were at an end. I became a number. Six. But I promised myself I would not forget I was once a person with a name, Sybil Delling, and that I would call myself that name again when my tenure at Ashling Cathedral was up. There were 5 other girls, all the same as me. A number. The abbess brought men and women to the cathedral to see us. Lords and lay folk, nobles and knights. They would ask us questions, and in the spring, with the blood of strangers on our lips, the omens showed us the answers, good or bad. Diviners, we were, holy daughters of Ashling Cathedral, harbingers of gods. The years came and went. Again and again, I stepped into cold, oily water, looked up at the stained glass window, petals and wings blending into a bizarre visage. Again and again, I drowned and dreamed. And in all that dreaming, in all the holy things that came of it, I broke my promise. I forgot all about Sybil Delling.
Settle yourself, Bartholomew. Your dream is at an end.
In the sacristy, laid out on a bench behind a velvet curtain, I coughed. I was back at Ashling, back in my wet divining robe. The cathedral was dark now, its windows inky. It was night, and I was alone. Alone, save for
5 bad signs.
It was the bat-like gargoyle again.
I'm shocked the young king didn't soil himself. I usually find abject humiliation a joyous affair, but watching young Castor, oh my, you were vomiting.
I was. Hands locked in fists, I rolled over and spilled the meagre contents of my stomach onto the sacristy floor. The gargoyle let out a shrill noise.
I scrubbed those stones this morning.
I clenched my eyes shut and heaved. Was the one who scrubbed them?
I laboured to supervise.
After the abbess shook me awake, the dream shut off, like a flame snuffed. But I was hazy after a divination, sometimes for hours. A gargoyle would carry me away from watching eyes to the sacristy, and I would lie in a foggy, sedated state. When my mind sharpened, I was always sick. I draped myself over my knees. What time is it?
Night,
said the gargoyle. I can see that. Are the others abed?
Indeed.
He grimaced.
The knighthood, too.
I coughed. The king is still here.
The abbess offered him the dormitory. Perhaps she pitied him. And what a useless thing pity is, for a guest is always a kind of trespasser. Why, just while you were lazing here in the sacristy, I caught a few errant knights lurking around the spring. Don't worry, I set them right.
He tutted, then reached for a linen cloth and crudely patted the bile from my mouth.
Feeling better?
Everything hurt. The muscles in my brow, my jaw, my stomach, sick from ingesting the spring water. There was no mark upon me for the injuries I'd incurred in the dream, but the pain from a broken collarbone, from wrung-out muscles, was still a ghost in my body. I'm thirsty, I rasped. The gargoyle glanced at the floor, desecrated with my vomit.
I would escort you to your cottage, but it appears I have swabbing to do.
I rose onto wobbling legs. Sorry for the mess. He stuck up his nose and didn't bid me good night. Outside, the air was chill. Not saccharine and putrid like rotting flowers, but fresh, its effect purifying. The tor boasted no trees, just gravel and stone, and grass speckled with gowan flowers. Above, the moon was a pale fingernail in the sky, disinterested in lighting my way. It didn't matter. Even with a damp shroud around my eyes and no lantern, I found the path through the grounds that led to the stone outbuildings that rested in the ever-present shadow of Ashling Cathedral. There were 6 buildings, besides the cathedral, upon the tor. The largest was a 2-level dormitory with attached stables that were often empty, but now smelled of manure from the knight's horses. The 2nd largest building was an ivy-laden cottage where the abbess lived. Directly behind it was the dining commons, and then 2 more cottages. One for the gargoyles, who didn't eat or drink but did enjoy sleep, and one for the diviners. The last building was a tiny stone cottage that sat far on the south side of the tor, where the wind was loudest. No one ever went there. The cottage had no windows, just an ancient iron door. A sad excuse for architecture, and utterly abandoned for it. My walk through the grounds was quiet. I wound my way past the stables, the dormitory. All the windows were dark. Either the knighthood were somber for their king's ill portents, or they were abed. But then I rounded the abbess's cottage, coming into view of the dining commons. I blinked. The common windows were bright, and a knight, armed to the teeth, was stationed at its door, looking straight at me as I came from the darkness.
Oi!
I skidded to a standstill. The knight, bearing a sword on her belt and a lethal-looking axe in her left hand, marched toward me, squinting against her torch.
Who's that?
My voice was a croak. Six.
Who?
Six. The knight kept coming, aglow in the yellow torchlight. She had ornate bronze and gold and silver rings in her dark, cropped hair. A sharp nose. Lines between her brows and around her narrowed gaze that made me certain she was older than I was. Her green eyes had charcoal drawn around them. They widened as she looked me over.
Bloody pith, diviner.
She lowered her torch. You look like a ghost in that... I followed her gaze down to my divining robes. The white silk, still wet, left no part of my body to the imagination. I'm on my way to my room, I said, clipped. At this hour? I've been dreaming, or have you forgotten the divination? The knight stared. Not in the awestruck way strangers who came to Ashling often did, but more meticulous. I haven't forgotten, but everyone has gone to bed, your diviners and abbess included. The gargoyle let me rest in the cathedral. She perked a brow. You need rest after dreaming. I doubt a simple soldier would understand the complexities of divining. The knight's brow rose. For a splintered second, I felt shamed, talking down to her like that. But then my good sense kicked in. She was, after all, a knight serving a king whom the omens clearly did not favour. No remorse was due. I'm thirsty, I said. Well, she tapped her boot over dirt. It would be this simple soldier's honour to walk you back to your dwelling. I nodded at the building behind her. The kitchen is just inside. I'll get water here. I'll bring you some. Thoughtful, I pivoted around her. But unnecessary. Wait, diviner! She reached for my arm. Wait! I wrenched open the door to the dining commons. Bent over, boots unlaced, another knight sat upon a long wooden table. He wasn't wearing armour, or chainmail, or a tunic. He wasn't wearing anything at all above the haphazard lacings that kept up his trousers. He turned at the sound of the door, dark eyes skittering to a halt over me. Firelight caught along the three gold bands in his right ear. The knight from the road. He was smoking something. A small, smouldering twig that smelled sharp, like nettles. Just like when we'd locked gazes earlier, me on the wall, him upon his horse. There was no warmth in his eyes. Then he spoke. Not in curt hollers like he had from the road, but lower. And I thought maybe that's where all the warmth of him lived, in the fervid, coal-stoked depths of his voice.
What's this, Maud?
The knight behind me, Maud, apparently, shifted. I'd stopped mid-stride over the threshold, leaving her half-jammed in the doorway. I found her stumbling in the dark. She said the next words, slowly, pointedly. She came to get a drink of water.
Hey!
Another voice called. I jumped. I hadn't noticed the second figure in the room, near the fire, looking at me with rounded cheeks.
That's my diviner!
King Benedict Castor. He nodded at me in greeting, proffering a bright, boyish smile. Gone was the trembling king. This one, despite the abysmal portents his dream had yielded, looked entirely at ease. Quite an experience, divination, he said. There was a